Just probably waiting. I'd like to thank the people in the background who arrange food and arrange accommodation when I come to Ottawa. It's not too often said, so I should just like to put that in. I would also, you know, there is very much a tradition in the teaching about doing service for the Lama. But I think that people that do this service are, in fact, equally the Lama, because they make it possible and they share in the merit of it, and they are an integral part of teaching. I hope that sinks in. Very important, because you know, so much in teaching is focused on, you know, we being, you know, the big hoopah on this. And the people who are in the background make it possible are somehow, you know, somewhat there or something or other. But I think that is a wrong view. I think that anyone who makes teaching possible is in fact a teacher, even if they don't open their mouth. So I just like to put that in. And so I think also we should all appreciate. If I have been lax to say so in the past, it is because in the teaching there's a very strange thing, that is, we don't normally thank people for doing good things. Does that make any sense to you? It's an Eastern approach. They think, well, when you do a very positive action, it's its own reward. And you do it because it actually assists you to unfold on the path. So you don't hear in the order, from the order standpoint, this is a classic view. It's not Western behavior or Western politeness, but it's a very Eastern view that you would be insulting someone sometimes by saying thank you. Isn't that strange? I mean, it's an unusual idea for you to work with. But if you ponder it a bit, you will see it. Someone's been to Russia?
Yes,
I see that. Those are done by two villages north of Moscow. I think the two villages. It's a box. You're referring to a box?
Yes.
It's very beautiful lacquer. Might I show them? Beautiful lacquer box. Miniature. Rather, I suppose, originally from the tradition of icon painting. Very fine, very beautiful. Shall we begin? We're almost at time. And we have lots of fresh air. May I explain that to you? I'm sure that you will indulge me in it. It's a little bit of an emotional blackmail, but can I use it? When I was quite young, after several years when I was living also in Burma, it was only discovered when I went to Thailand, I had tuberculosis in one lung, and it healed over from very early days of being the ascetic. So since that time, I have been very vulnerable on the question of good fresh air, lots of air taken into the lung. So if you will indulge that for a bit, and with excuse that you can think that if you get cold, you're toughening yourself up for practice. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. This evening, I would like to correct what I presume, if you have a typical Western being approaching the teaching, Eastern teaching, tends to gravitate towards, say, the practice of meditation. And it becomes very much the meditational focus. And of course, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was once asked, I think, on CBC, what Christianity could offer Buddhism. And he replied sort of something like doctors and hospitals, compassionate works.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was asked the question in reverse, you know, what can the teaching of Buddhism offer the West? And he said meditation. And however, teachers say many things on different occasions. On another occasion, His Holiness was asked about practice nowadays, and he said, well, this is the gist of it. It is very difficult for people to attain nowadays the meditational path. Their lifestyle is not quite the same. You could imagine, and so he said, in this day and age, what should be stressed is ethics, the moral practice. You have to imagine India 2,500 years ago, when you had mendicant monks, rather like the Order of St. Francis, that wandered from place to place. And they would, in effect, tent with an umbrella tent. Imagine an umbrella for against the rain, and off from it a type of mosquito netting. And they would just wander for 9 months of the year from Deer Park, Visipatanarama, to a forest area, and be available for teaching. And then 3 months of the year, they would retire and stay in one place, still sometimes available for teaching, but more or less to develop the meditation path full out. So for 9 months of the year, they would travel, and they traveled all the way over, apparently, to the court of Philip of Macedon. Down to Sri Lanka, over to many other countries, wandering, establishing universities, teaching centers. But 3 months of the year, when they were not involved in their studies, which we will call for the moment academic, although they were for the attainment of wisdom, they would stay in one place, and they would do a meditational retreat during the rainy season. And during that period of time, I'm trying to take you back into that long time ago, they would not move because they didn't want to disturb new life coming. It was in the sort of spring, because they didn't want to break these new shoots that were coming up. And the for most of nature, this is the sort of mating time for the birds and the insects and all the rest of it. And their offspring are coming in spring so they can get a good summer feed and prepare for the winter. So during that period of time, it's called the rainy season, which is also very muddy everywhere, that's rather pragmatic, they didn't move, basically. And also because that was the case, they could focus on a meditational subject in great depth for 3 months, 20 hours a day, 19, 20, 21 hours a day. And so many of their insights and their discoveries about the nature of the universe, the dharmas of the universe, came from this very, shall we call it, professional standpoint, total immersion. And it's a bit difficult to, you understand, sort of juxtaposition the teachings and the attainments and the realizations that came that way onto the present society. Because I think most of you, with all goodwill in the world and a little bit of effort, might manage an hour a day, something like that, if then. and it's not quite the same, bringing the same oomph to it. You accept this?
Mm-hmm.
So the Dalai Lama, anyway, thought that the teaching that should be for people is to involve them in the mindfulness of right thought, right speech, and right action in the midst of life. I don't want to denigrate in saying the path of the laity or anything, please, because I think it has to teach a lot of the order also. And we find that in the second oldest meditation book, which is a book known in history, it's published in writing, that at the beginning of it, it's a book called the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, which is a very voluminous work, a very, very thick work, innumerable pages, is dedicated to a type of teaching which first establishes the morality, and then on the basis of that, the meditational path, and then on the basis of the meditational path, the path of wisdom. Now, understand that it's easier to meditate than to be moral. I hope you, because it's the most confusing subject. I mean, it's very easy to say, go and focus on the, say, earth mandala of earth, or go and watch the breathing and stick with it, and that happened, oh fine. That's very straightforward. Believe me, teaching of meditation is very straightforward. But when you enter the field of morality, so you need two things. Two other things anyway. First of all, you have to be scrupulously honest in the what might be called examination of conscience. Mm-hmm. And you will see also your moral values change. There are many, many issues involved with it. And of course, above all, you have to have a continuum of mindfulness, recollectiveness, and viewing what you are thinking, what you are speaking, and what you are doing. So this evening I'd like to take you through certain considerations. Now, before we go any further, one of the great difficulties is there is a vast difference between country and country of what constitutes good morality, and even in certain religions what constitutes morality. And even in Buddhism there is a great difference in what constitutes the correct base, the correct motivation. So what I'm going to suggest this evening, possibly on Sunday morning, we might view some purported higher teachings which come from the standpoint of compassion. But tonight I'd like to speak about what is basic morality. The basic morality. And the basic morality of, may I put it in Buddhist terms tonight, only more or less in Buddhist terms. And then you can compare it in your mind with other teachings that you may know of. Fair enough? The first precept for every Buddhist, I'm not trying to make Buddhists here tonight, I'm just trying to tell you, right? There's millions of them in the world. The starting point of it all is I undertake to train myself to refrain from killing and harming. Now, I have to, before I go any further, most people receive a type of revelation about what constitutes good morality. For example, in Christian terms, thou shalt not this, 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 and this. And in addition to that, I think I'm being fair, by the way, right? And in addition to that, in other words, that's a proclamation of what you don't do from God. from external power. In addition to that, you have the church or churches declare at different times in history what you can do and what you can't do. And it comes from the church. It comes from some authority outside of your being. Is that fair enough?
Right.
And that's what most people. Now, in some of the societies in which I have lived, it is moral to kill. I'm not talking necessarily in Canada or the United States. That is to say, I have, or people that I visited. For example, I visited Irian Jaya. And at the time that I visited, the year before, they had killed a few missionaries. Didn't like them for some reason or other. And they had, it was very debatable whether we could visit these Azmat people. And the reason why was that they have constant village-to-village warfare going on. In that society, if you didn't go to kill, you understand, or you, the other village, you were letting down your people. And it was viewed as an immoral act. There's no question about conscientious objection or anything of that nature. It was condemned. I've actually met people in this life who ate their mother, father. And I have met people and they considered it a good act. Talking about views that exist in the world, bizarre as they may be. The idea was, may I give you the rationale for eating your mother? You may be interested. But it was that they had come to a point where they were very decrepit and old and about to die and were a burden on the society, and they should go out in style, as among the other peoples. And what you did was you tied your dear sainted mother to a tree and you bent it down and then you let it go and catapult effect and you dashed whatever brains your mother had left after bringing you up. I mean, and that was it, against the cliff. And then I guess you also, I do have a sense of humor. I have an Irish black sense of humor. So you had to tenderize me. This is really bad Irish humor. And you ate her because that was to respect. That was respect. It's sort of the cannibalism aspect. Even in Thailand, the government had a terrible time. The government's Buddhist, and they didn't know how to stop certain practices. And one of them was you put in your will, they had a case where no will, someone left their liver and heart to their friends. And after their death, they had the liver and the heart and they ate it. And the government couldn't, and you see, it was respect to that being. Teaching, please, you understand. Now, I'm not suggesting this practice, I'm just telling you. In the world, I have met innumerable views about what constitutes the correct way of living. And before we rush in to declare them all false, and this is false, and we wouldn't do that, we have to understand that basically we have a conditioning. And our conditioning on many, many subjects is very indebted to the Puritans, in particular. And there are areas where we're rather inflexible about it. So I want to, however, put a basic Buddhist view before you, basic one. And what I want to stress is that you see the wording of it, the precepts. I'll talk about the lower and some higher precepts. I'll go through them very quickly. I undertake to train myself to refrain from killing and harming. I take that up consciously, and if you notice, it isn't because it was said by the Buddha or the order or anything of that nature. I take upon myself voluntarily, from an insight that is the best and most wholesome way to not dependent on outer authority, but by a personally arising insight. And you'll notice it isn't, now there are two views. I have to be very scriptural, to be honest with you, because some Tibetans speak with absolute, I will never tell the harm. I think that, however, the prevailing view, which I would support, is not to be to realize in advance that you will all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That is, it is a study. And I have to be, I'm now speaking sort of personally on your behalf, if you were saying in your mind, this is what you would have to say. I have to study and apply myself to consider what is killing, and how far you take it. For example, in the order you carry around with you, I don't know what you call it, like a tea strainer, so that if you took water from a stream, you don't, this is done today, by the way, in the order, you don't kill any creature. So you take it out and say, here, have a chance. You saw this last, when we were walking in a nature reserve, and there were two black mites. You know what mites are? Fell on my clothing. You might think I'm terribly virtuous, but actually it's very standard. So, and two of these black mites fell in. I think other people would just swat, kill it, scrunch them. But you cannot do that in this teaching. You think, this is a very, I mean, this is, I'm making my things that go on my head. This is a very curious creature. Look at it. It's really incredible and wonderful. And you take it off your clothing and you put it back in nature and you walk on. And that's, I'm trying to give it to you in practice. And even if a mosquito comes, instead of killing all the mosquitoes, you cure the humans, and then the mosquitoes don't have the disease to be transmitted. There's two ways to eradicate malaria. And so, preferably, I mean, there are Buddhists who do kill mosquitoes, right? Doctors, etc. But you have to, each individual has to work out their salvation with diligence. And diligently be involved. They must study. For example, the fifth precept, I undertake to train myself, but it's a study, a training, a learning process, to refrain from drugs and alcohol, drugs, that cloud the mind. How far do you take that? Individual study. But you have guidelines that you, the guideline is your study. You're not receiving it. You are thinking, that makes a great deal of sense, particularly in this environment. That's right, this society, which is going to disease, is cured by drugs, and hence producing other diseases in the wake of it. Now, to give you an example of that one, one of the teachers, one of the monasteries that I studied in Burma, the main teacher of that temple, wouldn't take alcohol under any conditions whatsoever. That is, even in the hospital, wouldn't take a medicine, or even if a doctor prescribed a tonic that had alcohol in it, he wouldn't take it. Fair enough? Now, individuality, please. Now, this being will occasionally, but not to the point, never to the point where the mind is clouded. You see, for example, if you were a drinker and you went out, it might be all right if I got drunk, but not really, because it would affect someone else. But I might also drive a car, and I might ruin somebody, I had an accident, and ruin someone else's life. But it might be possible, and this is my view of it, right, that the alcohol, the glass of wine, is permissible only, right, for a pleasant state of mind. I'm, in other words, a liberal. Not to the, however, never to the point where the being would be out of control and may damage their life, commit an error which damages their life or the life of someone else. and only if it were to better their life. St. Paul said, take a little wine for thy stomach's sake. So I would assent. I have an Irish background, but strangely an Irish teetotal background. You want to say what I'm trying to do? Not that you accept what I say about it, because the whole thrust of it is, what do you say about it? Where have you got with the issue? But I'm giving you two, and I'm giving you others. There are other beings in, usually in the Tantra teachings, who have been known to get sloshed regularly. We judge not, lest ye be judged. That's the point. You have enough on your plate to work out your ongoing morality in awareness without terribly much concern about what others are doing. So I'm being very open about that. We have teachers who, for various reasons, have been known to either be alcoholic or near to being alcoholic, that is in the manifestation. What that's on about, you'd have to work, but that's not, I just have to speculate. Not to judge. An interesting point. I'm just sharing what my view is. But there's an extreme. There's an extreme in the teaching. If you don't like teachers being drunk, you don't go to teachers who are drunk. If you don't like teachers that, for example, if you think tobacco is a drug, you don't necessarily go to teachers who smoke. But then, of course, you would pose the teaching to all Indian peoples, by the way, because tobacco is considered a sacred plant and is used for meditation. So what are you going to do? You see, there are, in every point along the way, considerations. Now, most people, for example, when it comes to the precept about false speech, say, well, it's sufficient if I don't tell a lie. But by the way, in the morality of the West, there are two major subjects, sex and drugs. And most of the focus of morality goes on those two things and not on certain other things which are of equal importance, that is, what you're doing with speech. And I'm going to give you a kind of Quaker come Buddhist view, that let your yea be yea and your nay be nay, you know. Now, speak to the point. There is nothing so conducive of wasting a lot of the life energy than idle conversations. You see, I'm not, strangely enough, on speech, I tend to be far more of a Puritan than some of the other areas. I'm just being very personal. And then the interesting thing about that is that the even fantasy conversations are kind of a lie to yourself. You're not in the reality. Not focusing on the reality. You're denying the reality by many of the interior useless conversations. Heidegger again said despair or distraction. I think the number one distracting thing that people do is tell themselves stories and conversations and so on that are very frequently boring and repetitive and go nowhere, but occupy the time. The very valuable time of life. So I really do think that if one is to be a fully moral person, you have to see not merely what you're speaking out loud to other people, but to yourself. You have to view these false speeches that you have. And then, of course, that includes things like boasting and gossip and this and that and the other and, you know, the whole host. And then, of course, there you, in your study, yes, you would start to refrain from telling lies, but in your study, you would have to go deeper and deeper and deeper what constitutes false speech. Fine. In the sexual category, there are two levels. One of which I'll speak about later, which is when you go to, well, I'll speak about it first. When you go to meditate, and you may take it as a guideline, that when you are in meditational retreat or in a depth serious study, listen to this very carefully, you should be totally celibate. Totally celibate. And the issue behind that is basically the conservation of energy. Energy. That's not so much a moral, you may not view that as a moral consideration, but as a practical consideration. Because if you are not in a meditation retreat, then as far as the Kami Sumi Chatura category is concerned, it normally and is translated as I undertake to train myself to refrain from unwholesome sexual activity. And then we come to this most dreaded of all subjects on the face of the earth, and is going to require a great deal of energy to plod your way through it. But there are certain, you see, many people want to say, well, should I do this or that? Can I do this or can I do that? And in this teaching, there are only certain things which are utterly forbidden. Utterly forbidden. You may or may not agree, but nevertheless, I will put it to you. First of all, rape is never allowed, never promoted. Okay? Let's get that very clear. Child abuse is never allowable. Slavery, sexual slavery, is never allowable. Alas, in this teaching, prostitution is not on, ever. So on. So you begin to, there's only about four or five total prohibitives. You can fill in the rest of it. There's a full range in Buddhist countries of heterosexuality of different patterns. Sorry about that. The monogamous path may be the preferred and ideal path, but we'll call that the white path. Then there's a sort of, right, we've already talked about the black, and then in between there are some problematicals. For example, there are countries in which several wives is accepted in the culture of that country, which happens to be Buddhist. There's also at least one country or two where it is possible, permissible for a woman to have several husbands. Sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander, sauce for the goose, right? And there are innumerable, we'll call them grayer study areas. Homosexuality, question, lesbianism, question, not totally prohibited, not necessarily ideal, but to be studied. Fair enough? Give you the guideline. Another precept, not to take, listen, it doesn't say, I undertake to train myself to refrain from stealing. It says, a little more subtly, I undertake to train myself not to take that which is not given. Unless something's expressly given to you, there are no little borrowings. That sort of thing. Little smudging of the line. I mean, obviously stealing is up. Stealing, for example, is up. Uh-huh. But what about profits? You know, in business and all that. See, the study goes to starts to open some little clam type little numbers that people don't want to look at.
And you don't see as much scandal in the say the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail. Such and such a company took $2 billion in profits over and above. You know, I mean, you know, the medieval age, by the way, you couldn't even do that. You weren't allowed to make profit. People in the medieval ages, the church, by the way, forbade the taking of doing an usury, right? Mm-hmm. And so on. And if you wanted a loan, and unfortunately one of the Jewish people got stuck with it, if you wanted a loan of any kind, you had to go to Jewish people. And they would be almost the pawnbrokers of the medieval ages. And of course, you know what happens about that. Hatred. Indebtedness and so on. So that's part of that legacy there. I'm not very knowledgeable, because I'm just saying the church wouldn't allow good Catholics to do it. And it was against Scripture, the morality of Scripture, so it didn't occur, and there are other ways around it. In fact, there's a terrible scandal of popes were elected by bribery and things of that nature. I guess it still would be, but... Huh? You understand? I mean, who knows how they get to be heads of our political parties by bribery and corruption. And you start to open a whole field of study. But basically, never mind in the life of other people, what are you doing with it? Are you getting your wherewithal honestly? And you feel honest and correct about your income, etc.? And that you are engaged in a wholesome livelihood. You're not necessarily killing animals or anything of that nature. That would be considered to have broken the first precept. In general, please. Hmm? But there's things that come out of all this. Hmm? You steal from other people, you may be killing them, maybe harming them. So the precepts are interrelating. I'm just trying to give you issues, views that would be almost automatic response. For example, no Buddhist by principle is in favor of abortion. Now, before you might put in your protest, I say by principle in favor, in other words, not in favor of abortion. They would love to have it any other solution but abortion. Maybe more intelligent sex or whatever it is, and not conceiving, but it's the last thing. Now, this does not mean to be against choice, strangely enough, because that's the other person's, that's their responsibility. A teacher, please understand, cannot, a teacher of Buddhism cannot, you can be in favor of the person and sympathetic and compassionately hold and relate to the person who has to have an abortion, but you cannot promote abortion. You may lay out the facts in front of the thing, and they must make the choice. So then, strangely enough, you might end up in a position that could be pro-choice and pro-life at the same time. So, but please do not accept what I'm saying, because there are innumerable Buddhists with innumerable studies, personal studies going on. And they have their lines. So on. Fair enough? You hear. So that what we're trying to say to every being is, I've outlined about five precepts there, and become an intelligently involved being, and you come to your various conclusions. For example, life is not easy. And did you know that? For example, what do you do if, say, the Nazis came to your house and you were hiding Anne Frank or someone, and they say, "Have you any Jews here?" "Oh, yes, Mr. Nazi officer, you're up it." I don't think that's going to be fun. Because then you're killing some way or other, or participating, so what do you do? Silence? Or do you sin? Oh, no. which is about something like a Burmese mode. There's a Burmese, yes. When in Burma, when if you go to someone and if you sit into a Burmese person, would you lend me $1 million? They would say yes. You may never get it, but they would say if I. And what they're saying in their mind is, if I had $1 million, and because you're such a wonderful friend of mine, I would love to give you $1 million. Would you lend me $1 million? Yes. And all the rest of the dialogue is not necessarily fit. So you can ask people for certain help, and it may or may not be forthcoming. They will try to help you, but they will always respond to a friend with a yes. And I suppose with a Nazi, you always say no. And you're not necessarily telling a lie. I haven't any of those. What you think is, you understand what they might have thought, vermin or inferior. There's none of those before. I think I have a precious friend there, but you didn't ask about that. You asked about this picture that you have. So there are some, there are many deep subtleties. Between the letter of the law, which you could be a scribe and Pharisee, and, you know, you heard about that one, haven't you, in the Bible? You're also pure, but you're not really pure, because there's a guideline of what constitutes good morality, and that is, if an action of yours makes you feel not in the state of love, unfriendly. In other words, it breaks your state of friendliness. It is an unwholesome act. It is a sin. You have an inner guideline. Your body will tell you that. It's very, very simple and straightforward. If your action breaks compassionate involvement, you have broken the essence of the precepts. If your action breaks unitive joy between people, shared joy between people, it has broken the spirit, the letter of the law. If your action breaks serene union, unitive field, then your union with the universe in which you are, then it has broken the essence. It's an immoral act or an unethical act. So you look at what the action does to you. Hopefully you develop wisdom gradually that your actions help others to enter into a state of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and surrender. But first of all, you definitely, all beings have to focus on their own being. And study. And in the course of study, you come to insights and a much better feel and sympathy for what other people are going through. So therefore, you fulfill the high precept of compassionate, loving kindness, compassionate, joyful, serene involvement with all beings that you meet. So there are guidelines. And the guidelines are in the interior, not just an abstract light, but what you actually experience. The body doesn't lie. Your brain can do all sorts of things in your conversation, but your body doesn't. And you know, it's compassionate to you to observe a moral path because you feel better inside, loving kindness, and you're not punishing yourself. That's a wonderful guideline. You're compassionate to yourself not to have unwholesome activities. It's compassionate for your existence. And it leads to more joy in your being to be a moral being. And it definitely also leads to more serenity in your being. Fair enough? So go back, fulfill the moral path, you will come to awakening. All you have to do is have a constant awareness present whether or not you are in a state that is wholesome. It's called the sukha state or moral state. That's all. There are, however, if you go for special study programs of meditation, and I may also give it as a, I know it's going to sound very strange, but even if you went to, say, university and you were committed to a program where you want to take any program in depth, they might have something to say to you. And they're rather more, not so much you might think of them as morals, as help you to unfold to deeper understanding. I'm going to call it the sort of Quaker principles here. One is, I undertake to train myself not to, I don't know if you translate it, not to eat at unfortunate times or out of time, literally out of time. Vikala bhojana varamani sikapadam samadhyami. That is, a pragmatic, please, instead of stuffing yourself with fast foods and erratically so, you go to the ads for senna pills, be regular. That is a great basis. It's a very important principle. You know, you might be actually a more moral being if you ate wholesomely and regularly. I'm going to let you work on it. But when you are particularly need your energies for depth study, you should start taking the higher precepts. Another one, I'll give you examples. Avoid, this is the real Quaker Puritan. You're probably not really conversant with this one. Is you give up singing and dancing and movies and television and da da. No, I didn't say anything. There's five precepts. The five precepts say nothing about that. Go and sin. In love. Go and sin. You might feel you want to relax with television. Fine. But when you go for meditation, can you intuit this? You are getting lost into other subjects. A, first of all, the quality of the television and this and that and the other is not a very high standard in any case. I just think that is sort of a sign of my mind anyway. But it's splitting your attention.
Yeah.
It's a pragmatic because it splits your attention. So that's another one. Another of the precepts, the higher precepts, are very Quaker. I'm sorry about this. Some of you are guilty. Right? You give up on adorning your body and cosmetics and men. This is also addressed to men, by the way. They don't use brute. And they don't put the emphasis on that subject. The narcissistic mirror number. That takes your attention away from unfoldment in meditation. So you dress simply. Not that necessarily the cosmetic or the perfume. I can assure you that in Buddhist countries, people do use cosmetics. They use perfumes. If it helps to other people also to be particularly happy, they do so. All right? But it's called a higher precept because when you're going to do higher or deeper things, you need an extra oomph to it. So you just pretend, if you wish, that you're in a Carmelite convent. Do you understand what I'm saying? And you drop that level, just drop it off from your body, come all the little needs that you have to sort of keep yourself up a bit back, and try to develop keeping yourself up from within. Not dependent on another. Not dependent on your husband or your wife and all this type of thing. And even, of course, when you do depth study work, you give up. Some of you would be very happy to give up, I'm quite sure. Definitely meaningless interpersonal relationships, totally. And it's highly dubious whether you should have even the focus outside of the interior. But you can debate it and look on. What else have we got? Oh! you're constantly sinning. I can see it now. If you went there, you have to give up high and luxurious seats. So, and you can sign near you. Whatever is that about? In those days, and still today, did any of you see? How was it? The last emperor. And you saw in China. In other words, high and luxurious seats were ego posturings in the society. So you enter with a type of feeling, may I give it to you, of you're all dressed the same, you sleep on the ground, you are one of the rather Islamic type of approach, you're one of just millions of the spawning humanity, you have no position in society. This applies to Lama too, by the way. They should not have any consideration of that. They should be quite prepared to lie on the floor, you understand, or take a very lowly position as if we're just from the earth, give up all these posturings and pretensions in the society to be somebody, and all that. So the precept of giving up is the symbol of giving up society recognition, the search for society recognition. And the last precept of the higher one is I undertake to train myself not to handle gold and silver. Because, again, in those days, well, nowadays, now I know you, you're very technical beings. You see, you're letter of the law beings. I know you. Right? You'll be that type of being. It doesn't take alcohol under any conditions. So, you will come to me. I know you because you're a letter of the law being. You'll come to me and say, well, I haven't handled any gold and silver. You probably haven't had any money for years. I've just handled green paper or orange paper or... I've just been handling paper, but the meaning of it was when you are going for a depth study thing, meditation, or something else, please, even you know, if try to fulfill the precept of putting down business, if you can, clear the debts, clear it for study, pay your bills and forget it, and you understand, then it'll be easier for your mind to let go into the studies or the meditation. So I've seen a lot of people who no sooner do they begin a meditation or retreat say, you don't mind if I've even had one, do you mind my broker calls me up? I say, well, you're broken the precept, right? You still got your hand over there, you still got your little mental hands, you know, out there just to save me, save me in case the meditation goes in case I don't become a Buddha. We're fully away from your Buddhas, by the way, in essence, all beings. I want to stress that, by the way, that Buddhas, by the way, are not male, right? All beings here present are Buddhas, at least your Bodhisattvas, your Buddhas to be, and you have Buddha nature, and it will awaken. And then you'll be an actualized one, a practicing one. Now, but you know, that is, well, in case that doesn't occur, I want to make sure that my business affairs don't deteriorate in the meantime, that I have a home and a house, you know, to come home to and a bank account, etc. But it is not good because it splits your focus. And you need, there's a five-fold focus. I'm going to conclude with this. There's a five-fold focus that you need for the path, for spiritual work. And shall I just outline it for you? And then you hear these higher precepts against that. You must be also remember, one of them was already enunciated. When you're going for depth work, that period, maybe another period, that's something else what you do. But during that period, you must be totally celibate. Got it? So, in addition to the high and mighty places and the no moneys and the no adornments and the irregular meals and not give up your frequent Mac attacks, etc. Give all that up. But you need five things. And I have to, it's from a sutta that the Buddha gave. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's about the 16th, somewhere around there. It's called a Chaito Thila Sutta, the posts of the aspiring mind. I wish there were 15. But five of them, is fivefold principle. You must develop the concentration, condensing. In other words, concentrated work. Not concentration, but the concentration of concentration. Now, before I get complex about that one, the first thing you have to do, you have to have very strong intent, determination. You must state in your mind what it is and develop the aspiration, the will. To, for example, know a certain subject, achieve a certain thing, you need intent. The second thing that you need is not merely the thought of enlightenment, but you need the energy for enlightenment. You better conserve your energies, concentrate your energies, so they're not scattered all over. And that's what the five precepts, five higher precepts, are all about. Look, it's very, very simple. If you wanted to become, don't you believe, if you wanted to become a great musician, concert pianist, or you wanted to become a highly skilled surgeon, or you wanted to achieve mastery, mistressy, whatever you want to call it, you know, conquest in a certain field, that you make sacrifices for it, right? You don't let your energies go all over the place. You really conserve energy. So the second thing that you have to concentrate is energy. And then you have to concentrate, the third thing is you have to concentrate concentration. That is, you have to maintain a continuum of focus on the subject that you want. Just to keep with that theme. Dropping other themes. The third concentration that you need is the concentration or intensification of exploration, of investigation of the field that you're involved in. Not merely read it, but really examine. I used to work in a laboratory, I don't know about the review, was in the Department of Parasitology. And one of the works that we did with was, strangely enough, with a praying mantis, right? The creatures that was on the road to see about the effect of cancer cells, strangely enough. The work was with cancer. And, but investigation, I'm going to call it the sort of microscope principle. So you're concentrated on the subject, but you've got to bore into it and really get in there and look at all the details. So on, not just gloss it, but get the details. Same with the question of morality. And the fifth thing is a word which is translated normally as effort. It's wirya, but in fact the word has been translated V-I-R-I-Y-A. Should be translated a different way. And with apologies for the women here, but I think you will note, you will know what I mean by it. Manliness. Or the heroic principle.
Gumption.
Very good. Gumption. Guts. But be prepared to face, you know, the overcoming of the wimp tendency if some new discovery comes up and it upsets, you know, upsets you. You've got to be willing to go on. So the word wirya is either normally translated as manliness or heroic. And you need the heroism of many mothers, by the way, to keep plodding on and working and with the hope that we'll go through something. So that's an extra fifth push that's needed. And this gives you an idea. The reason why I put those five in is because the general immorality wastes a lot of energy. Nothing is so conducive to wastage of energy is when you don't have any subject, you're going to defeat it, just wandering around. And that's when the devil finds work for idle hands, and there is depletion of energy. All right, you get basic morality in place, but the extra dimension is the question, how can we get more conservation of the energy? And that was why I put in the other five. Killing and harming takes energy away from you. False speech takes energy away from you. Unintelligent sexuality without what you would call a meaningful relationship generally also takes energy away from the being. Being motivated to exploit other beings takes energy away from the being, from the path. And of course, drinking drugs waste energy. But even if you've got through those five, there's an extra dimension, which I've already explained to you in terms of the other pragmatics. An extra dimension. Don't waste time with too much involvement of food. Get your act together. Get it happening at correct times so that the digestive process is not taking too much energy away in your being and filling your mind. And you're not being motivated to, put the dog on kind of number. That takes energy to do that, by the way. To paint yourself up, and I mean that dress and paint and be the doll, male or female doll, takes a lot of energy in life to maintain that level. To maintain the pretension in front of other people, your status, that takes a lot of energy. Etc., etc., etc. Well, now you've heard it, and what I want to re-emphasize, along with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, seems to be a very good company on that point, that this is a meaningful path for any being. You have no excuse. You can get full awakening if you only held the question, what is moral? And you studied it. What is an ethical practice? So, may you be well and happy. Sabbe sattva sukhita hontu. May all beings be well and happy. So, that's it. Who knows, I've cut off discussion. Because, I think that gives you something. You can go and study it in more depth, and that's what you should be doing. If you need more instruction about it or more exploration about it, there will be a class on Sunday morning. They haven't told me what time. Tomorrow is a work day, and I think you'll find it tremendously supportive because it's direct work. So we will work directly together, I and other beings will help you in the course of the day. And we've been cooking what I call, we called it in Toronto, we did it at the Rudolf Steiner School, a normal working day. I consider these studies to be normal for a human being. I do not consider most of the stuff that goes on, particularly in Ottawa, being my civil flight Torontonian pig, to be not that meaningful. You know what I mean? Not a little bit abnormal. What they've sold the humans into. Really, it's very abnormal. Many of the things that go on in the whole business, economic world, it becomes a great, really shock to them. Have very little to do with being a human being. Distorted view, false view. Do you have a sense of, does it ever hit you, though, really hit you, when you pick up a paper, a sense of unreality?
Yeah,
a sense of unreality. This is abnormal. How do human beings get into this? How can it, I mean, you couldn't even read it in science fiction. No science fiction author could ever do it. It's bizarre. And the, strange enough, the more you practice awareness, the more bizarre it becomes. And I can understand why the first monasteries were never, that was then, 2,500 years ago, they wouldn't allow a decent monastery to be in a city. That was then. And it hasn't got any better. It really hasn't got any better. The people, cityites, they live in the strangest states, right? The only thing is, that can be said, it's a commonly held neurosis. They're actually insane, really. By any heavenly standards of outer space, I'm sure if other beings came down from outer space and looked what was going on in humanity, they'd say they're insane. Heidegger again, the dreadful's already happened. They're split off, they're living in fantasy world. I mean, well, I don't want to belabor the point. I mean, money is a fantasy. It's actually a fantasy. The government, the whole country is bankrupt. I mean, that's the truth. May I just take one more? I'm looking for a comment. The Minister of Finance gets up and he says, we've cut the deficit. This is utter trash. All that's happened is that they're not quite as much debt being added this year as last year. It's only 30 billion or whatever it is. It's only 30 billion. But people go, things are getting better. They're not, because they actually worse. I think money is a very good thing, where you see people live on promises, fantasy promises. Fantasy promises. That's what it is. So anyway, I think maybe tomorrow we'll do a normal working day. And to me, the most normal thing you can do is become a healthier, happier, very trite, healthier, happier human being, and that actually has the most pragmatic effect on other beings. That's the cause of peace in the world. Anyway, again, be well and happy.
So for those who aren't coming tomorrow, what time will we meet on
something? Yeah, you're here to tell me. Don't consider me. I mean, I just have to drive about 4 hours back, you know, to my house over icy, bumpy roads. But don't consider that. Consider.
How about 7:30?
Well, not for me. But these poor beings. I told you already that Canadians lack. They are noted in the East as weak, wimps. They're noted for it. I'm sorry. Right? In Thailand, in Malaysia, they say these Canadians that came to practice, they seem to be unable to put in the number of hours. Not like the Japanese and the Israelis and other people, nationals all over the world. Right? They just can't put the time in, you understand? Softies. But at least you have a record that, and I don't say this strange enough for ulterior motives, of being the most generous people. Isn't that interesting? I thought you should at least know that. So if you don't got you. If you don't give, you're not very serious. but it is interesting. They're usually good hearted and they're generous people. But they, and it's understandable, they don't drive themselves. That's why I kind of pushed the concentration, the fivefold concentration. One thing is they don't particularly trust. You see, when you really trust and you get excited by an idea, you begin to put passion into it. And it's difficult to, may I just say this, right? To arouse passion in anything. You might do it with a European, but you will not do it with hewers of wood and drawers. The image, you know, this is the image somehow to go right out there, right? Is there an easier way? You mean, do I really have to meditate? I know you're secretly hoping. Do I really have to meditate 19 hours, 20 hours a day? Say, no, you don't have to. See, I did that. You don't have to do that. All you have to do is 24 hours a day of morality. Yeah.
The point is, you're King's mind.
Yeah. Yes. But they were French. You were European. They probably were born in this country. They came over to, right, to explore the country. The explorers did it. Right? That ever since you've been living in your little cabin and hoping the wolves don't get you. Any questions?
But couldn't drawing wouldn't.
Yes, it could be. There are other things that count. Okay? But also playing tiddlywinks could be a meditation also, you understand. It depends on you being recollected what you're doing. Being focused. Anything can be used for the path. That's a great saying in insight. Anything can be used for the path, particularly wholesome things, of course. But even if you have unwholesome things present, at least try to learn. And I've seen people who experienced bombing attacks and war and lots of hate was arising in their being. But they somehow heard it and were able to transmute it and learn from it. So even if you get the upwelling of a shadow in your being, at least be aware, and maybe you have a possibility. And I think the ones that really don't get liberated are the ones that have no awareness that they are in a state of sin. May I tell you one very funny story? You have to be a European to appreciate it. And we got on a Dutch vessel that was going out to India. And we stopped at Cape Town to take on water. And then there's this, like, 10 days after that, you get over to Sri Lanka. And 10 days at sea. So the group, the group of Dharma students, we decided to, it was, I think, maybe for the New Year's, to make a please. We're Buddhists. We're not Hindu, right? I mean, Hindus may consider us to a certain extent, but anyway, you'll appreciate this story. So we decided to make an image of Kali. For fun. Excuse me. A museum for Passy Lutong. And you made a huge statue out of many, many balloons of Kali and decorated her. Because we were going on our way to Calcutta. And in Calcutta there's Durga Puja every year. And they take the statue of Kali or Durga, which is the destructive element, and so on. Decay, corruption, the passing of time, Kali's time, time destroys everything, that type of motif. And they take this statue, rather like you might have in Italy, the parading of the Madonna, right? In Sicily, they might throw almonds at it, that kind of thing. And anyway, what happens, you take this figure down to the riverside and you throw her in, and that takes your sins away. So, we made this out of balloons, quite a passable Kali figure, and painted it and decorated it with garlands and bracelets and using imagination, and we took it out to the deck, small deck, and the captain of the ship was Dutch and Frisia came in, and a sort of a Germanic type of voice. It was, what is das? You know, what is this? What is this? And he was very, very much an evangelical Protestant background. So, and we were innocent children, I can assure you, only innocent children, as well as his colleague. And we thought we would just sort of give our sins to Polly, and then we'd throw her overboard, and she would take our sins away. You see? It's a very symbolic type of thing. The Tibetans do it too. You visualize your sins disappearing into the void of the universe, the great sea, and dissolve it, you see? I mean, we're not even... We're only semi-serious, you know. We would like, of course, sins to go away, but... Anyway, so we turned to heaven, and he... Oh! So, I think it was Cecily who said, well, why don't you, you know, think of your sins being here? I have no sin! Alas! none are so damned as, right, who have no sin. And then I guess you'll pass through a period of time and think everything you do is a sin, and at least that might slow you up and begin to transmute. So better the sins you know than the sins you don't know. Hello, come on. I hope you will make effort. Remember that one? Effort, and have a little manliness about Sunday morning, because it is an extremely important question, and I want to deal with the law and the spirit. And search for that. Anyway, here we are. I think people in the West need ethical teaching. I really do think so. Before they approach meditation, they should know morality and ethics.